Lots of things to pray about as we will get into the Word tonight. I find it fascinating that the psalm that we're in, the first psalm that we're going to cover, Psalm 76, to me it speaks profoundly to where perhaps your heart might be sitting tonight. I know it did for me. To the chief musician, it says on Neganoth, a stringed instrument it is. It's another psalm or song of Asaph. And he says this in the first three verses. You could, camp on this for quite a while. I'm not going to, but we will talk about a few things here. You know, in the ministry, we would say, this will preach. And this is the reality of what we all need to look at again tonight. And I want you to listen to what he says. In Judah is God known. His name is great in Israel. In Salem also is his tabernacle and his dwelling place in Zion. In those statements that we just read, what you need to understand is the names of these places are not, again, accidental. They all have meaning. Judah means praise. And Israel, of course, means ruled by God or God rules. In Salem, verse 2, Salem, of course, means peace or the place of peace, the peace of righteousness that comes. Remember, Melchizedek was the king of righteousness, came from Salem. Jerusalem, right? The place of peace. So, Salem, peace. And Zion, which means actually an interesting name, Zion, sunny and raised up. Now, I want you to listen to me for a minute. I'm going to reread this verse and listen to the way it sounds when you insert the meanings of these words. In praise is God known. His name is great when he rules. In peace also is his tabernacle and his dwelling place in the sunny, raised up place. Now, what you need to know is that if you're looking for God to be known by you or by anybody else, then he is known in praise. In praise, it says, in Judah is God known. His name is great when he rules. When I can really exclaim and proclaim that God is great, it's when I am allowing him to rule my life. And in many contexts, in many ways, at many times, that particular statement might fall short or fall flat. Huh? In fact, there are times when I can't even get those words out of my mouth, perhaps. Because maybe God's not ruling parts of my life, and so therefore, it's hard to get that out of my mouth. Hard to get that to roll off my lips if he's not ruling. But this is a key. And in peace also is his tabernacle, or the place where he dwells. He dwells in peace, God does. And so when I'm at peace, God is, of course, the reason why I'm at peace. So if I'm not at peace, there's something wrong. Not with God, but with my tabernacle. Because he's a peaceful God and wants to give me peace. And also, then in Zion is his dwelling place. The sunny, raised up spot. That's what Zion is. The mount of Jerusalem, where Jerusalem really has its centerpiece. The Temple Mount is known as Mount Zion, the sunny, uplifted, raised up place. And it is. You know, you have to go uphill from any direction to get to Jerusalem, to that little mountain, hillside-ish kind of a city on a hill. But watch this now. He rules in that way in my life when I am submitted to him, folks. And here's the result of that kind of living. If you're praising his name, you know God. He's known that way. And when he rules your life, you can say he's great. His name is great. And in peace, you will find your tabernacle filled and his dwelling place will be in you in that particular place. And Zion, that sunny, awesome place of his dwelling, you will experience it. And then what? Well, there, in that place, in that reality, in the peace and in that wonder that comes through what I just explained, with praise going up and all the rest, there, in that place, break he the arrows of the bow, the shield, the sword, and the battle. God just defeats the enemy. Doesn't he? But why is it? Why is it that so much of what we would have to say is the professing Christian world, the church, and many people in our nation, why is it that we don't seem to have that going on? There's a defeated kind of mentality so often, that we're not victorious so much of the time. Why is that? Well, it goes back to the first part of this psalm. Praise is lacking, right? So there's, you know, you just don't know that reality because you're not praising his name. He's not ruling, perhaps. God may not be governing. You may not be allowing him to govern. And also, there may not be any peace in your life as a result of that. In your tabernacle, there may be turmoil. What would cause that? Sin. Veering off from what God might want me to be a part of. So what would I expect then if I'm not living in that reality? Would I expect then all the victories and all the arrows and bows to be broken in pieces like this statement is making here? Would I expect that to happen or not to happen? See, there's a reality to living for God that many just miss. Somehow, there's a kind of a misnomer about Christianity, that if you just do certain things, you can claim Christianity as your own. And you can. I mean, if you believe in Christ, you are a Christian. You're born again into the family of God. But it doesn't stop there. It doesn't end there. There's a whole life of him breaking the bows and arrows of the enemy, taking care of the battle. And I think this is profound, actually, that this psalmist says, here's how it works. In praise, God is known. Are you lacking intimacy with God? Then praising him more would be the answer. If you're not able to say with integrity, his name is great, it's because he's not ruling enough of your life. Israel, God rules. And if peace is not in this tabernacle, then something else is and needs to go. And then, of course, that dwelling place of sunny, raised up reality, that, this is great, just the warmth and intimacy of God, Mount Zion. Hey, if those things are lacking in me, then perhaps I'm not experiencing the breaking of the arrows, the battlefield that should be wiped out before me, maybe isn't. Well, is that all there is to it? Kinda is. I always find that if something's missing, I need to go back and say, okay, so what is it? What's going on here? Because it's always something that I am either allowing or not allowing, I'm pursuing or should be pursuing perhaps, and not pursuing something else. It's always something in that area for me. And the battlefield here that the psalmist, I believe, is referring to is in 2 Kings 19, there in verse 35. Where the Assyrian army was wiped out by one angel. What did the children of Israel, Judah in particular, what did they do? Did they beat the Assyrians? No. It reminds me of so many battles that Israel won without really doing anything but praising God. Jehoshaphat is a great example, wasn't he? They didn't do anything. They sent praisers out before the army. And the enemy was defeated. More praise is what's in order. More God ruling. More peace in my tabernacle. More intimacy in Zion. And then the battle seems to be won for me. Isn't that what we're after? Isn't it great to just think about it? Isn't it sound wonderful just to think that the battle could be won for me? Yeah, but what's your part? Praise? Letting God rule, let him have his way, whatever you want, Lord. Filling my life with peace rather than with turmoil, following his ways. Thou art, verse 4, more glorious and excellent than the mountains of prey. The mountains of prey are Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been onslaughted more times than you can almost count. It's been under siege so often and still is. To this day, it is the place of the prey. People are trying to prey on Jerusalem. Always have. It's God's place, and the enemy sees to it. But watch this now, going back to what 2 Kings reports. Verse 5 says, the stout-hearted are spoiled, stout-hearted, those that just think that they've got it without God. That's the idea. I don't need God. I'm stout-hearted enough. Well, they're spoiled, he says. They have slept their sleep. It's an interesting statement. They have slept their sleep, and none of the men of might have found their hands. Now, of course, you understand, during that attack of the Assyrians, the angel of the Lord just came in at night, and nobody could find their hands, meaning they were totally taken off guard and totally wiped out. When they got up in the morning, the children of Israel went out, and the whole Assyrian army was wiped out. 185,000 men destroyed. When the angel attacked them, they couldn't find their hands. They couldn't find a means to defend themselves. And they, these stout-hearted ones, were the ones spoiled. They took a spoil of them. It's interesting, that term, they slept their sleep, means they weren't alert. They weren't awake. You know, the whole world's kind of asleep right now. You notice that? Don't you just want to shake the world and wake it up? Don't you feel like that sometimes? Just shake it. Wake up. Smell the coffee. You know what I mean? These guys were asleep, and the time came when God dealt with them. And the psalmist says, at thy rebuke, O God of Jacob, both the chariot and the horse are cast into the dead sleep, referring to Exodus chapter 15, where Moses sang that song, and of course Miriam sang it again there in Moses 15:21, that the horse and the rider and the chariot have been cast into the deep, right? God didn't allow the children of Israel to be wiped out by the Egyptians. They parted the Red Sea, God did, for the children of Israel. They went across, and then the Egyptians followed hard after them. And when they were in the middle, God caved in the water on them, and that was it. That's what God's able to do. The world is asleep, and God will deal with the world. Thou, even thou, art to be feared, the psalmist says, speaking to God. And who may stand in thy sight once thou art angry? Revelation chapter 6, verse 17. You don't want to get God angry and then try and stand in his presence. And people have a problem with this, I find. In John 5:19, John says this, we know that we are of God, and the whole world lieth in wickedness, or lies in the wicked one. The whole world lies in the wicked one, literally. And look at this now. I find it fascinating that in the midst of where we are, in the things that we are probably heading into, in Revelation 6:17, the great day of his wrath has come, and who shall be able to stand? What does the psalmist say? He says, thou art to be feared. Who may stand in thy sight when once thou art angry? When God is ready to deal with this world the way he's going to, no one will stand. No one will stand it. Now, I have mixed feelings about that. I have mixed emotions about that reality. Part of me says, right on, Lord. Take care of business. This world, you know, Lord, me and you, we'll shake them up. I want to shake them and wake them. And Lord, you do that, and I'm right with you on that. And he's going to deal with this world in his timing, in his righteousness. But I have to remember the other aspect of this, and that is, God desires none to perish. And I ought not to be in too big a hurry to see his wrath come, because people need to get saved. People need to get born again before this happens, before this wrath unfolds. And he says, thou didst cause judgment to be heard from heaven. The earth feared and was still. Judgment's coming. And the earth feared and was still. When God does something, and you know, we often will call certain things that happen in this world acts of God, you know, especially insurance companies when they don't want to pay for something. You know, anything can happen, but then when something happens they don't want to pay for it, well, that was an act of God. It's not our fault. How convenient. Blame God for it when we don't want to pay for it. But the point is that God is responsible for certain things, isn't he? He will allow certain things to happen and actually bring things to pass. We've seen that throughout Israel's history and throughout biblical history. But when he does something, the earth just kind of goes along with it. That's what this means. What's the earth going to say? When God says, okay, I want you to shake a little bit, the earth just says, okay, and starts shaking, right? If he says, I want the waves to go up this high, that's exactly what they're going to do. They fear God. The elements of this earth, the elements of this universe, they have respect unto God. When he says it, they do it. And I pointed this out before. Everything has respect unto God in that way. When God says something to anything or any element or any animal even in his creation, they just do it. Everyone except for people. We're the only ones that don't. Isn't that crazy? He gives us that free will. And boy, do we exercise it, right? Well, God says, here's the choice, this or this. Well, I think I'll choose this over here, right? And God puts in us the innate ability to choose right and wrong and a knowledge of what is right and wrong, and yet we still choose wrong much of the time. But he says when God arose to judgment to save, now this is why he rises to judgment. You need to listen to this. When he arose to judgment, it was to save all the meek of the earth. And he says, Selah, meaning think about that. God's judgment has not just judgment in mind like we think it does, but it has salvation in mind. God raises up judgment in this world sometimes, but what's the intent? Why is he allowing the judgment to come? What is the purpose of the tribulation, which is the greatest judgment the earth will ever experience? What's the reason God is bringing that about? Well, people say, well, it's a Christ-rejecting world, getting judged. Well, true, but it's known as Jacob's trouble. It's Israel's last call, and he will bring in his harvest during that time. God will bring about salvation to those that shall be the meek. It's amazing. Even in his judgment, he has that in mind. And the Great Tribulation, folks, will be something that brings about perhaps the biggest, largest act of salvation, evangelism, the world has ever known. Multiplied millions and millions of people, a number that couldn't be counted, of course. John says, I couldn't count the number. Those that were saved during the tribulation, I couldn't count them when he saw that vision in heaven. So there's a huge salvation movement coming. But it's going to come through what? A time of judgment. And I'll tell you something from a personal standpoint. When I got saved, it came, at least for me. Now, I know, it is the goodness of God that leads men to repentance. And for me, it was God's goodness and a healthy spanking. I was about as stubborn a guy as I think that there is on the earth. And God had to get my attention. And his goodness was used, but he had a healthy way of mixing judgment with it. You know what I mean? And he knows the mixture perfectly. He knows exactly how to go about bringing in individual children. Just like you and your kids, you know they're all different, right? Some of your kids, man, you can spank them and it doesn't mean a thing. Others, you can look at them sideways and they break down and start sobbing, right? You know what I mean? Our kids were all different. Some of them, man, it was like, okay, another discipline time. Wow, this is tiring. Getting worn out, And for others, it was just like, hey, and okay. I mean, it's like, okay, that's good. And I know people who have gotten saved with just the look, God giving them the look. I don't know about you, my dad always had the look, I knew the look, and I didn't mess with the look. up to that point of the look, everything's okay, but man, once the look comes, it's over. I'm done. And that's, how some people respond to God. God says, hey, that's enough. All right, I'm done, right? My pastor, John Corson, got saved when he was like 4. I'm thinking, what? 4? He got saved when you're 4 and then lived for God ever since then? Wow. Well, he was one of the ones. God just said, okay, that's enough. Okay. And he spared himself, of course, a lot of tragedy and turmoil and, all the rest. But for me, it wasn't that way. And maybe you can relate to that. But I was slammed hard before I finally got the picture. Stubborn, dumb, really. But here's the thing. Judgment to save all the meek of the earth, Selah, think about that. And surely, he says, the wrath of man shall praise thee. That wrath that man has within him, when God brings about judgment for those that get saved through that element of God's putting upon that person the reality of what's coming if they don't turn. What was it that Spurgeon preached? Turn or burn, he said. That's pretty harsh. But it was effective, I think. He had a pretty powerful ministry, you know, when you tell people, this is it, turn or burn. There's your choices. Those are your options. And Spurgeon had this way of saying things that was more powerful than I'm saying it right now, believe me. So when he does that, isn't it interesting that the wrath of man shall praise thee? Because there was nothing in me, I don't know about you, there's nothing in me but wrath. I was really a hateful person. I hated a lot of people. I just didn't like people. Really, I didn't. I liked certain people, but most people I could do without. And nothing in me was really all that pleasant, to be honest with you. But here's the thing. I'm praising God now. Praising him. That wrath was turned, wasn't it? And the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain. Or, literally, God says, I'll take the rest of that wrath and I'll wear it like a belt. That's what that means, literally. I'll put it on like a belt and I'll use that later. God's got this wonderful way of dealing with us. So he says at the end of this, vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared. Hey, we ought to just bring God our best stuff. Now, this isn't saying that you need to pay God to be his friend. It's not like bribing him. But he is one that ought to be respected, ought to be feared. I mean, if there's anyone in all of creation that should be respected and given, you know, that praise and given presence, who would that be? God, right? That's what he's saying. But I find it interesting because people take offense at this and they'll say, well, I'm not paying God. I'm not paying him anything. Who does he think he is asking me to pay? And some people take this down to the level, they shouldn't, but they do. They take it down to the level of paying, like giving offerings and money. You know, you always do that. I think, stop it. But here's the thing. What if it were saying that? Just think about it for a second. What if it were saying that you're supposed to pay God? What about that? What if it did say that? And I know that's not the context, and that's not what it's saying. But what if it were? I think it's interesting because I'm more than willing to pay for other things. You? I'll pay for all kinds of things that are worthless, meaningless, have no value whatsoever, and I'll fork it out for that. You know? Pull out, okay, sure. That's no value. Sure, I'll buy it. You know? Like my wife pointed out to me the other day, so honey, you have more shorts and flip-flops than the stores do. And I'm like, what? And I guess she's right. I mean, I don't know what it is about shorts and flip-flops, but that's what I wear. So I, every time I see something, oh, they're on sale. That's a pretty good deal, right? And I think I'm doing pretty good. So I bring them home because I'm thinking my wife will be happy because they're on sale. Because my wife is a real, I mean, she finds sales, right? And you know, personally, I don't buy clothes unless they're on sale. You? I like the clearance, right? That's my kind of buying, right? So I find shorts for like $2. Serious. $2. I'm thinking, I'll buy 5 pairs of those. Man, it's only $10 for 5 pairs of shorts, right? I bring them home. My wife goes, honey, I've got to clean the closet out now, right? So I'll pay for shorts, I'll pay on sale, but I'll pay for stuff that I don't even need, gladly. And yet when it comes down to this issue, and the psalmist says something like, pay your vows and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that are around him bring presents unto him. All of a sudden people, oh, I don't know. That sounds like, you know, legalism. That sounds like, you know, you're trying to ask for money. I'm not asking for money, by the way. God says, if you're going to pay anything in this life, if you're going to give anything in this life to anyone, who better to give it to than God? I can't think of a better place for anything to go. My praise, my worship, my offerings, my gifts, whatever. Best place it can go. But now he says, he's going to cut off. He shall cut off the spirit of princes. He is terrible to the kings of the earth, meaning he is awesome to those kings, those that think they're in authority. Now, this is just key, folks. Think it through with me. Just where we're at today, don't miss this. He is awesome over the kings of the earth. All of them. All the kings, all the presidents, all the rulers. He is awesome. And he can cut off the spirit of princes. He can do that. I have no fear. I have no worries. People say, aren't you worried about what's going to happen? No. I think we're closer to heaven. That's all. We're closer to heaven. We're closer to the things that need to happen in this world. That's the way I look at this. You know, again, I'm going to pray for our president, and I'm going to pray for our leadership. I'm going to pray for our country. And again, I exhorted us not too long ago, and I will exhort us again, that God says, if my people will call upon me, seek me, repent, then I will hear from heaven, and I will forgive their sin, and I will heal their land. The call is not to the pagan. The call is to the believers. That's our part. That's what we're supposed to be doing right now. So we're not going to sit around and badmouth everything and poor mouth everything that goes on. Just, hey, let's pray. You know, spend more time praying about what is going on in our country and in our world. You know, that's our part. Because he, you know, he's awesome. And even all the kings of the earth and all the rulers, they can't hold up to God. And when he's done, by the way, he's done. He's finished and it'll be over. Now, quickly, we're almost done with this, but I need to cover this next psalm. To the chief musician, verse, or the heading of over verse 1 says, to Jeduthun, a psalm of Asaph. This is a whole series of psalms of Asaph here. I cried, he says, unto God with my voice. Now, he's going to start sounding more like me in this psalm. Maybe you'll be able to kind of put your name in here a little bit too. But watch what he says. I cried unto God with my voice. I did this last night. I did that this morning. I cried unto God with my voice, even unto God with my voice, and he gave ear unto me. He listened to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My sore ran in the night and ceased not. I had dreams last night. I don't know about you. My soul refused to be comforted. Has this ever been your experience? Refusing to be comforted. Not that you can't be comforted, but you refuse to be. See, there are things that happen to us that are out of our control. And when we can't control things, it really bugs us. It really troubles us. Most of us are control freaks, and we want to control everything. And if we can't, it really drives us crazy. And when you can't control something, then oftentimes you're so confounded by it and so torn up about it, oftentimes, that even when God would say, well, I can comfort that, we say, no, I refuse to be comforted. Why? Because I'm enjoying this pity party. I'm enjoying it. I'm getting something out of this pity party. Now, here's something that you need to understand, folks. When you will not be comforted in the things that God can comfort you in, it's because of that reason. There's a payoff somewhere. The payoff is I'm getting something out of having this pity party, this feel sorry for me. I want you to note something here in the first half of this psalm. Watch what he says here. I'm just going to read it through and then I'll come back. But watch, and I want you to just count with me. I'll emphasize them so you'll get it. How many times he says, I or my. Okay? It sounds a lot like me here. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, even unto God with my voice. And he gave ear unto me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My sore ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Thou holdest mine eyes waking. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times, and I call to remembrance my song in the night, and I commune with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. Asaph's got a little problem. Same problem I run into oftentimes. Me. I'm my own worst enemy sometimes, and he's got eye disease. Me-itis he's got, right? It's all about him. Now, when he refuses to be comforted, it's because, of course, he's sore. His heart is sore. He's discontented. He's got trouble. But watch what he says. I remembered God and I was troubled. When he remembers God in this condition he is, even that troubles him. Well, I thought about God for a minute and that really bugged me. That really troubled me. Right? This guy's in bad shape. And watch this. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Man, underline that. Circle it. Highlight it. Do something to it. But when I complained, my spirit was overwhelmed. Well, try not complaining, Asaph. Right? Try not complaining, and maybe you won't be overwhelmed in your spirit. Because this is true. The more I complain about what's going on, my condition, my situation, and some people, folks, are just professionals at this. They're professionals at talking about their troubles, and that's all that matters to them. Every single time they talk, it deals with that issue. And they always say they're overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed. Oh, it's all these troubles, right? And as they start to complain, God hasn't come through here. This hasn't worked out there. The complaining brings more overwhelming to the spirit. It's a trap. And Asaph here is experiencing it. And I have too. Selah, think about it, he says. Ponder that. Right? Now, thou holdest mine eyes waking. He's blaming God for keeping him awake. You just hold my eyes open at night. I can't even go to sleep. You know, like God's got my eyeballs, you know, pinned back. And he says, I am so troubled that I cannot speak. Well, he's speaking, saying a lot, actually. It's all complaining, but he's talking. He says, I considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I thought about the old days, and I call to remembrance my song in the night. Songs in the night aren't always good ones. Songs do come in the night. When you wake up in the middle of the night, and this doesn't mean you start singing, you know. When you're troubled, the last thing generally you're doing is singing. But you wake up in the middle of the night, and it's really the dark time of your life. You wake up, and it's troubling. Something's really on your mind, on your heart. Something's overwhelming you, and you wake up sometimes. You ever done this? Middle of the night, and you just lay there. And it always seems darker, and everything seems bigger and more difficult than it really is in the middle of the night. You ever notice that? Even getting out of the bed seems more difficult in the middle of the night. It is for me. But everything seems tougher and darker. And the song in the night, he says, I remembered my song in the night, and I communed with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. He says, I started thinking about it, though, and I started searching my heart and started searching why I'm in this condition. What am I doing? He's asking himself. And then he starts asking really dumb questions. I know you've never done this. You know, asking dumb questions. I've done this. I've said almost these same words, and it's so silly. But he says, will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Selah, let me think about that for a minute, he said. And again, he's saying, has he done that to me? Is this what happened? Is this why I'm in the condition I'm in? Because God forgot to show mercy? Because God forgot to be gracious? God has left off doing the things God does. Is that true? No. You ever ask these questions? Oh God, where are you? What are you doing? Why aren't you showing me mercy? Why aren't you showing me grace? Oh, he is. He is showing you grace and mercy every single day. And then he says this, the turning point finally. And I said, this is my infirmity. First wise thing he said so far. This is my infirmity. My infirmity. I own it. This is a great thing to say, by the way, folks. It's a great truth to embrace. Oftentimes when something is wrenching me in my life, the first thing I want to do is pass it off and give it to somebody else. And you think, well, why would you want that to be on somebody else? Because it's not fun. And the last thing you want is to own it. This is somebody else's trouble that I got. I'm going through this because somebody else has done something. I'm going through this because somebody's done something to me, and God isn't noticing it. But he finally says, no, 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 this is mine. It belongs to me. It's not out of order, and it doesn't belong to somebody else. It's mine, my infirmity. And he says, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. He is shaking it off in our term, in the way we would say it. Shake it off, we would tell somebody when they're having a pity party, right? You ever said that to somebody? It's not a popular thing to say. But when they're having a pity party, when somebody's just filled with self-absorption, right? It's all about me and I'm pitiful right now. And don't you want to listen to me some more? No, frankly. Shake it off. Stop it. Right? Wrong. Is that what you're saying? No. Yeah, really. I mean, it's not up to me to tell the person to shake it off, but it's up to the person to tell themselves to shake it off, just like the psalmist is doing here. Maturity in the faith, growing as a believer, is when you don't have to have people tell you to shake it off anymore. You tell yourself to shake it off. You start to grow up. You don't have to have other people inviting themselves to your pity party. In fact, you don't want to have pity parties anymore. They're no fun anyway, except for you, right? That's why nobody comes to pity parties, right? You're never going to throw a Saturday night party and say, come to my pity party. Bring your own misery, right? We'll just have a party together. Nobody wants to do that. It's no fun. But here's the thing. When you start growing up, you don't need other people to tell you to shake it off. You start making that determination yourself. That term, but I will remember. I am making a determination, he says, a decision to get off of myself. And you'll hear it right here in his language. He's not going to say, I, me anymore. He's going to say, thou and thine. He's going to start talking about God and his ways and his power and his awesome ways of dealing with things. And it changes everything. He says, I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. And he says, I will meditate also of all thy work and talk of thy doings. I'm changing my focus, he says. Focus is now on God, and things are going to start looking different. When I get my eyes off of myself, it may not change anything as far as the circumstance goes. It may not affect it in one way, but I will change. Things won't change necessarily. The circumstance may not change one bit, but I will change when my focus gets removed from me and placed upon God where it belongs. I fix my eyes on him. And he says, man, I'm going to remember and start talking about the things that God is doing. This is the cure, by the way, for self-pity, for self-absorption. You start thinking about God and things that he has done. How? Oh, what has he done? Well, he's created the universe, died on the cross for my sin. Those are biggies. Allows me to go to heaven, not hell. That's huge. His mercies are new every morning. That's important for me, right? His grace is sufficient for me. That's good, right? I start to reiterate again and again, remembering all the things that he is about and what he does. And then I start to realize, hey, he is good. And then what? Then talk about him. He says, I will talk about thy doings. I'm going to tell others about what you're doing. That's the cure, folks. That's the cure. The discouragement, the depression, the overwhelming things that come because we complain so often about how things are going. In fact, the reality for me anymore is I don't really care what is going on in this world all that much anymore. Why not? You should. You're a pastor and you should care about everything in the world. Well, I don't. I don't care that much about what's going on in the world. I do care about what God is doing, what his ways are accomplishing, what he wants to see done. Oh, the world might be affected, but my focus isn't the world. If I look at the world too much, too long, I'll guarantee you I'm going down in discouragement And I'll start to feel real pitiful, feel like giving up hope. Like, oh, yeah, yeah. How are we going to, you know, how are we going to make it? I mean, how's this world ever going to, I mean, it's just terrible. I mean, every, you know, watch the news for a while. Well, if you dare. I mean, it's like, wow, right? This place is miserable. And if I sit there and focus on it, I'll guarantee you I will go down into the pit. And again, it's not that I don't care what's going on in the world and the things that are happening in our nation. I do, but I don't care to the point that I don't care to let that rule my life. Again, back to the original psalm we looked at. That's, you know, that's for the world to deal with, in a sense. God's going to rule me, and therefore, this tabernacle is going to have peace in it. This man right here is going to praise, and that's how I'm going to know God, and his name will be known by me. Anything else going on out there? Well, that's the way it is, I guess. I'm not going to change the world, but I can let God change me. And thus, if we all did that, then God changing us might have an impact on this world. The focus needs to shift, guys. Not looking at the world and going, oh, brother. But looking at God and saying, wow, you're awesome. You're still awesome. You're still altogether lovely. You're still everything to me. You're still my all in all, even though everything else seems to be falling apart. You're still the one. Lord, I just can't believe you're so cool. You're so amazing. You're never out of style. You're never unworthy to be praised. You're just great and awesome. And I can focus on that. And for me, then my heart starts changing, like the psalmist here. So he says, look, I'm going to talk about his doings, the things that he's doing. Thy way, verse 13, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? Do you hear his tone change? He's like a whole different guy all of a sudden. Not complaining. He's talking about God and his spirit's elated and lifted. But I want you to note that term in verse 13. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Hebrews 10:25. Do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together. The way of God, folks, the answers so often are in the sanctuary. The things that we're really wrestling through. How many times does God answer those questions in the sanctuary as we go through the Word? Right? And I'll tell you something, I know that there are people who say, well, I don't need to go to church in a formal setting, anything like that. I'll just walk with God in my own way and do my own. Well, I'm sorry, but you're out of order when you do that. People are out of order. God says, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together because you will be weak. Isolation breeds weakness spiritually. We need each other. We need to grow together. You need to fellowship with each other. We need to pray for each other, share the word with each other, right? And the way, oh God, he says, that you take is in the sanctuary. This is where we find, you know, the children of Israel turned the sanctuary into a thing that it never was meant to be. And it was a shame. And I look at that historically and I think, oh, those children of Israel, they really blew it. But wait a minute now. Christians are in danger of the same thing. You turn the sanctuary into a place that you go and have an event, and then you leave. But this is to be a place where we see and meet with God and learn from him. You see, to be isolated, folks, is not the way. I've never met somebody who's isolated as a Christian who was ever doing well. You? You run to somebody, hadn't seen them, oh, in years. Hey, where have you been? Well, I've just been doing my own thing. How are you doing? Terrible. Right? I mean, it's just always the way it works. No fellowship. They're not growing, right? They're not sharing. They're not encouraging others, which is all part of the deal. And there's answers in the sanctuary as the word is shared. So he says here, thou art the God that doest wonders. Verse 14, thou hast declared thy strength among the people, and thou hast with thine arm redeemed thy people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw thee, O God, the waters saw thee. They were afraid. The depths also were troubled. The clouds poured out water. The sky sent out a sound. Thine arrows also went abroad. The voice of thy thunder was in heaven. The lightnings lightened the world. The earth trembled and shook. Thy way is in the sea, and thy path in the great waters, and thy footsteps are not known. God's way is also in the sea. Now we'll get to Psalm 107 eventually. Psalm 107 talks about the fact that God has this way in the deep waters, great waters. When you know God, I'll guarantee you something. If you keep walking with Him, your footsteps eventually will end up in the deep. His footsteps, it says, are not known. When you go into deep water, that's when you're going to really know God. The depths, the things that take place. Psalm 107 says, they that go down to the sea in ships do business in great waters, in deep waters. That's when they know that God is real. You know, it's kind of like the picture that's painted there is going out into the sea, the ocean out in the deep, and you're in some little boat, you know, and the waves start rising up and going down and like, whoa, right? And it gets pretty gnarly out there, right? Well, if you've ever been in that situation, you know how earnestly you're talking to God, right? When things get deep in this life, and they do sometimes, and I'll guarantee you folks, and this is not a warning, this isn't to put fear into you, but the more you walk with God, the more intimate you are with Him, the deeper the water gets, and the more dependent you become on Him. And that's a great thing. Oh, I don't like that. I don't like deep stuff. I don't want deep water. I don't want the waves. Don't like that. You know, I get seasick. It's just going to be so, though, that the Lord will take you into deep waters. And He takes us in deep waters when He can trust us. When He can trust you, He takes you deeper. And when He trusts you more, He takes you deeper still. Remember what Corrie Ten Boom said. There is no depth that you can go where God is not deeper still. She knows what she's talking about. See, we have it wrong. We think we're being punished when things get deep. When life gets so difficult sometimes that you have nothing but God. It's a great honor. It's a great honor. He's trusting you with just Him and nothing else. And that's when you'll know. And He says at the final verse here, verse 20, Thou leddest thy people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Remember, He led them out of Egypt like sheep, and He was their shepherd. He used Moses and Aaron. But He's still doing this, by the way. He still does this. You know, He takes me into deep waters. It reminds me of Psalm 23, right? Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, deep water, I will fear no evil, right? For thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. What is that? Those are implements of a shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. That psalm begins with. So even though I go through deep waters, He leads me by His rod and His staff. He leads me like one of His flock, and He leads me where He wants me to go. And sometimes, and I'll guarantee you again, no matter who you are, if you want to go with the Lord to where He's going, it involves deep water, it involves trouble sometimes, it involves dependence upon Him. The more I grow in my relationship with God, the more dependent I become on Him, not less. It's not like, okay, I'm so spiritual now, I don't need God. Not. The more spiritual a person is, the more absolutely dependent on God he is. It's like, okay, I get up in the morning. Okay, Lord, I'm not going to do anything till we talk, right? I mean, that's the way I am. I don't know about you. I get up in the morning before I do anything. I'm in the Word, and I'm talking to the Lord because I dare not begin a day without consulting with Him. Lord, what are we going to do today? What do you want to do? What do you want to use me for? You know, how are you going to pull that off? And what are you going to do with that? You know, and without that, listen carefully, without that, I'd be just like this psalmist. I'd be so overwhelmed. I get up in the morning because, you know, I know what you think sometimes. Hey, being a pastor, piece of cake. All you do is sit up there on that stool and just talk a lot. True. But I would be a wreck, so overwhelmed, truly, if it was not for being with God on a perpetual, constant, continual basis. So if He wants to go deep, we'll go deep. As long as He's there, I'm okay. You know, if I thought for a minute we're going to go deep and he's not there, I'm out. You know, I'm not going to deep water without him. But he's in the deep water. He's in the deep water. He's in the storm. Remember, Jesus walked on the water in the midst of the storm. Disciples freaked out. Jesus was in the midst of that. Strong, sure, right? Which would you rather be, on shore without Christ or in the boat in the storm with him there with you? See, that's the reality. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word. And I praise you for you being so faithful through all the things that we go through in life. And even in these Psalms tonight, there's just such a blessing. There's just such a reality for me again to realize that, oh, I can be so self-absorbed and so consumed with things and complain, and my spirit gets overwhelmed when I complain because I'm focusing on the wrong thing. But when I look at you and I think about all that you've done, oh, my heart begins to soar, and I begin to ponder all the wonderful things you've done and begin then to talk about you. And pretty soon I'm in the sanctuary where you're working and doing the work again and learning and finding answers and fellowship. And Lord, you're just great and you're awesome. And we praise you tonight for your word. And even now as we come to the table, I would just pray that we would all remember the one important thing in our life is what took place on that cross 2,000 years ago, securing our salvation, making it possible for us to be in a relationship with you, Lord. And now as we make time for this, I pray that each one of us would place absolute importance on this remembering. Even as the psalmist said, I will remember thy works, O Lord. And here tonight, we will remember your works, remembering the greatest work that was ever done for man. And so, Jesus, we do remember you. We remember that this was a sacrifice that completed, accomplished salvation for all of us. And so now we come and remember you as we just spend some time in your presence. Speak to us, and as you do, may we acknowledge, may we repent and confess sin if that's, Lord, what we need to do tonight. And I'm sure for all of us that's true. And if we have other things to discuss, Lord, may we just spend some time quietly, just a few minutes, just spending time at your feet, in the process remembering your blood and your body for us, each one of us personally. You did this. You died for me. You died for us. We will remember that tonight and commit it to you in Jesus' name. Amen.